a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hi, I'm Emily Salmon. I'm going to interview Dave Jones, and he's going to kindly answer all my questions on the Earth and space in general. So the first one, how far away is the edge of space?
Okay, so I've answered this, I've taken this in two different ways.
Cool.
Right, because I didn't know whether you meant the edge of space in terms of if you left Earth, how far would you have to go before you hit space?
Oh, okay.
And how far would you have to go to reach the very edge
of
space?
Yeah, I like that.
So I'll go with both of them. I'll answer the big one first. Right, so originally, naively, I thought, okay, so the universe is nearly 14 billion years old.
Cool.
So the edge of the universe that we can see is the speed of light times 14 billion years. And that's how far away, that's the furthest thing that we can see.
I like that's very logical, actually.
Yeah, so that turns out that that's actually a 1 with 23 zeros after it in kilometres. So it's a fair distance.
That's cool, yeah.
But I forgot to think that space has been expanding since the start of the universe. So if you actually take into account that space has been expanding,
lots of math,
you actually see four times further than that. So the universe is actually four times, the observable universe is four times bigger.
Excellent. That's cool.
Than if it was just always been there.
Brilliant.
Okay, so then the start of space, that's a little bit tougher because this is a bit semantics. So around about 90% of the atmosphere in terms of mass is within the first 16 kilometres after you leave Earth. But the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale defines it as the Kármán line, which is a location that was calculated by a Hungarian physicist called Kármán as the altitude at which air becomes too thin for you to fly an aeroplane. Because to fly an aeroplane at that speed, at that location, you have to exceed the orbital velocity. So you basically, to be able to fly at that distance from the Earth, you'd escape.
So right?
That would be space.
Space.
So that's the sort of European definition. And that's about 100 kilometres.
The Americans have a different one.
The Americans do. And the Americans have more than one as well. Depending on whether it's NASA or everybody else. So NASA define it as around about 50 miles. And anyone that goes above that is defined as an astronaut. But the definition has actually changed. So recently, in the last couple of years, I think it was in 2006, three astronauts were retroactively given the title astronaut because at the time they flew very high. But NASA's definition of space at the time was actually above where they flew. And NASA have now dropped the definition of space down to 50 miles.
Huh.
So now they've become astronauts, even though at the time they were just pilots.
Cool. And our next question, why are little me green men green?
This is a really interesting question and one that I really liked. So I went and did a little bit of research.
Excellent.
And it turns out that the term little green men was in use well before it was synonymous with aliens.
Okay.
Right. So it's been around in folklore and mythology, and like leprechauns, for example, are little green men. And there's loads of examples of things like that. And it wasn't until the sort of 1950s that it became synonymous with aliens. For example, like in the 1940s, some American newspapers used the term little green men to talk about camouflaged Japanese snipers, which I think is quite interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's loads of examples throughout history and throughout literature of little green men.
Fantastic.
Even before aliens.
I thought they're made out of chlorophyll.
Well, that's the other idea. So if you come off and you ignore all that and you decide that they are actually aliens, so one good explanation which you just mentioned is that they could be made mainly of chlorophyll, like plants,
yeah.
And that could be how they get their energy. So instead of eating like we do, they just sit in the sun for a bit. And that brings us on to a really interesting thing, and the reason why plants are green is because the sun's energy output actually peaks in the green. The type of star that it is means that it's a sort of yellowy-green star, even though we see it as a sort of orangey yellow thing. The peak of its spectrum is actually in the green. And it's also the point in the spectrum that our eyes are the most sensitive to. So maybe we see little green men because our eyes are just more sensitive to green than any other colour.
Brilliant. So it's like, how do you know if something's not really another colour it's in because we view it at the same time?
Exactly. It's a pretty tough question to answer.
How do you know there isn't a lot of planets that we can't see because they don't emit anything?
Okay, so the first thing I'm going to do is define a planet.
Cool.
So it kind of comes down to four different points, four different boxes that anything has to tick to be called a planet. It has to be in orbit around a star. It has to be sufficiently massive to be in hydrostatic equilibrium, which is a very fancy way of saying it has to be round. And then it has to have cleared its local neighbourhood of other things. Basically, it has to have smashed into everything around it and cleared everything around it. And this is where Pluto fails, because there's lots of other stuff floating around near Pluto, around about Pluto's size. So it's not managed to clear out everything around it. And then the final point, which comes back to the question about emitting things, is a planet can't be an energy source, like a star.
Oh, okay. So it emits.
So it can't emit anything. It can reflect.
Yeah, that's why.
But it can't emit.
Bright.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that kind of brings us on to how do you detect planets? If they don't emit anything, how can you detect them? And they're done by three main ways. The wobble of the host star. So as a planet goes around the star, the planet doesn't go around the star. The star and the planet go around their common center of gravity.
Okay.
So, which is normally very, very close to the star, if not inside the star, because the star's much bigger than the planet. But what actually happens is the star sort of wobbles a little bit. It's not completely stationary because it's not at the center of that system. And so we can detect that wobble. So even though we can't see the planet, we can see the star wobbling as if the planet was there.
How do you detect the wobble?
Well, that's using a technique called spectroscopy, where we break up the light from the star into its constituent components. And because we know what the atmospheres of stars look like in spectra, and we know that they contain certain lines, certain absorption lines. So when you look at the spectrum of a star, it emits at all frequencies, at all wavelengths. And then at certain specific wavelengths, that gets absorbed. And we can tell by at what point it gets absorbed in the spectrum, at what wavelength. We can tell not only what is in the star, but also what speed, what velocity it's moving away from us. And we notice when there's a planet around a star, those lines move backwards and forwards as the star wobbles.
That makes sense.
So then there's two other ways as well, which are becoming more popular now. One is transiting. So as the planet passes in front of the star, it blocks out a little bit of its light and makes the star appear fainter. So there are huge eclipses, exactly. So there are huge projects going on to try and detect these things, one of which is called Super WASP, which is the Super Wide Angle Search for Planets. So this is 8 cameras that were bought on eBay.
Really?
Monitoring huge quantities of the sky all the time, every night, to try and find stars that get a little bit brighter.
Do you know where that's based?
There's one in the Canary Islands, which is monitoring the Northern Hemisphere, and then one in the Southern Hemisphere, which is in South Africa. And then the final way that they detect these things is through gravitational microlensing, which is really complicated, and it's when the planet gets close enough to the star, it can bend some of the light from the star.
Okay.
Because it's big, and make it a little bit brighter. And I think we shouldn't go into any more detail on that.
Excellent. Okay, next question. What would you think would happen when a black hole meets another black hole?
Well, NASA actually performed some massive simulations of this a few years ago. And up until a few years ago, that would have been impossible, because this is such a complicated system, two black holes, that it would crash any computer that you tried to run the simulation on. So they managed to run this simulation using 2,032 computers, and it took them 80 hours to finish. So if that was done on one computer, that would have taken 18 years. Right, so they ran this simulation, and as you would expect, it releases a huge amount of energy. You know, it's a really impressive thing. But unusually, it releases all of its energy, pretty much all of its energy at least, as gravitational waves. So not as an explosion, not as light, not as heat, but as gravitational waves, which are like ripples in space. And in fact, it's so powerful, this collision of two black holes, that it would release more energy in gravitational waves than if you added up all of the energy in all of the starlight from all of the stars in the universe.
Wow, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
And there's a rule about computers, isn't there, that every 2 years they double in power, or 8 years or something.
That's Moore's Law, I think it is. It gets twice as fast.
Yeah, that was it.
Half as big, whatever, every so many years, yeah. So that's why it's only recently been able to be done. And these gravitational waves are actually kind of interesting as well on their own, not just in terms of noticing two colliding black holes, but we're actually searching for these things using gravitational wave detectors, which most of them are like there's one called LIGO, which is the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, which is basically a big tunnel evacuated, so it's got nothing inside it apart from two mirrors at either end.
So is it a vacuum?
Yeah.
Cool.
Two mirrors at either end, and they're using those two mirrors to measure very, very small variations in the separation between those two mirrors, because that's what happens. A space would ripple between these two mirrors.
Oh, okay.
It would get fractionally smaller and then fractionally
time
bigger.
Change as well.
Yeah,
as well.
But it has the same effect on the path of the light. So you would detect it by noticing that as you bounce the laser between these two mirrors, it gets marginally smaller and then marginally bigger.
Okay.
And that would also allow us to test Einstein's general relativity. It would be like the final test. if it passed that, then we'd know that it absolutely described gravity.
What holds the sun up if the sun holds the earth up?
Right, so I think the first thing that we have to do is try and define up.
Well, gravitationally, like.
But gravity goes in all directions. It's radial, so what's up for us is down for someone else. So I think I'm going to quote a passage from Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking here, which I think is quite apt, quite funny. So, a well-known scientist, some say it was Bertrand Russell, once gave a public lecture on astronomy. He described how the Earth orbits around the Sun, and how the Sun in turn orbits around the centre of a vast collection of stars called our galaxy. At the end of the lecture, a little old lady at the back of the room got up and said, "What you have told us is rubbish. The world is actually a flat plate supported on the back of a giant tortoise." The scientist gave a superior smile before replying, "What is the tortoise standing on?" And the woman replied, "You're very clever, young man, very clever, but it's turtles all the way down."
Yeah, I've read that, I remember actually.
So this is the problem, because there is no up.
That's true.
So basically, what holds it in place is that there's nothing to stop it from not being in place.
Okay.
So it's kind of, it's bound to the sun, just like the earth is bound to the moon by gravity. Kind of like if I swing a yo-yo around my head and I hold onto the string at the other end, then I could be the sun and the yo-yo could be the earth.
Yeah.
And gravity would be the string.
But what are you standing on?
But what am I standing on?
Yeah.
That's the problem. Because in space, I wouldn't be standing on anything.
Yeah.
So yeah, because we can't define up, we have a big problem there. But I think we can't actually answer that question because we can't define up. But it's interesting just to think about gravity for a second, because gravity's pretty cool, really. Right? Yeah. Because I think we all forget how important gravity is and how all-conquering it is. Because all of the other forces in the universe, like the strong force and the nuclear force and the weak force, the standard model, of particle physics, those other forces that other physicists care about work on very specific scales. Over certain distance scales, they're the force to be reckoned with.
Okay.
And everything else sort of fades away. But gravity works over much larger ranges of scales.
Okay.
So we all know just from every day that gravity works on a sort of an Earth-sized scale, because we're all held to the Earth by gravity.
But practical application.
It definitely has, and some downfalls as well. But and then it also works on even larger scales, because the Moon is tied to the Earth, and that's about 400,000 kilometres away. So that's already many orders of magnitude bigger than the scale of us tied to the Earth. But then the Earth and the Moon are also moving around the Sun because of gravity. And that's 150 million kilometres away. So that's about 4,000 times bigger than the separation between the Earth and the Moon, which is already many times bigger than the separation between us and the Earth. So we're already covering a massive distance scale here,
yeah.
But it gets even bigger. because the Sun, the Earth and the Moon are orbiting around the galactic centre, the centre of our galaxy, which is about another billion times farther away, right? And then our galaxy is in orbit with another galaxy called Andromeda, which is about another 100 times farther away than the separation between the Sun and the centre of the galaxy. So it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then the galaxy and Andromeda are in orbit around a local group of galaxies. And that local group of galaxies are in orbit with another group of galaxies called the Virgo Supercluster.
Okay.
And that's another factor of 20 bigger. So when you add it all up, not even considering the small scale stuff of us on the Earth,
yeah.
If you start and you say that gravity, the smallest scale gravity acts on is the Earth and the Moon, which it isn't. If you just take that as the smallest scale, then in total, you're moving 16 orders of magnitude just to get into that group of galaxies.
What's an order of magnitude?
Times 10. So that's like one with 16 zeros at the end.
Does that mean there could be one galaxy or something huge that we're all orbiting around anyway?
Yep, it's possible, but it's unlikely based on our understanding of cosmology.
Yeah.
We think that the universe is isotropic, which means it's the same in every direction.
Yeah, okay.
Right, so if everything was in orbit around one particular point, that would ruin everything for us.
And the last question, how do we know that it's iron, like molten iron in the centre of the Earth?
I think this is a brilliant question, because I had a little idea about this before I decided to try and investigate it.
Okay.
The fairly obvious one, and the only reason I could think of, is to do with the Earth's magnetic field.
Oh, yeah.
So the Earth has quite a strong magnetic field. And to have a magnetic field, you need something magnetic. So having a big iron core, basically a big bar magnet in the centre of the Earth, produces that. But then there are other signposts towards having an iron core, because fairly obviously we can't go down there and check that it's an iron core. So we basically have to use as much evidence as we can to conclude that it has got an iron core. So another thing that hints towards an iron core are certain types of meteorites called chondrites. And they have a very similar composition to the Earth. They're believed to be the kind of things that the Earth was formed from. So they were floating around the Sun, and the Earth sort of coagulated out of all of these meteorites. And they have a much higher iron content than is in the crust of the Earth. So that's a giveaway that there must be more iron somewhere, and it's probably in the core.
Yeah.
And then the real clincher, well, it's twofold. It's to do with the density of the Earth.
Yeah.
So we know the density of the crust based on what we've dug up. And from our understanding of gravity, we know that the core of the Earth has to be much denser. And it turns out it has to be about as dense as iron.
Okay.
And then we can check that that works by seismic waves. So if there's an earthquake
waves, yeah.
Absolutely. If there's an earthquake on the other side of the Earth, we can check how it propagates, how it passes through the Earth. And based on what it looks like at the other end, we can kind of tell what it's gone through.
Okay.
And it turns out it's gone through iron. And we're really lucky that we have an iron core. Because as we mentioned at the beginning, absolutely, as we mentioned at the beginning, produces a magnetic field, and as you just said, without a magnetic field, the solar wind would hit the surface of the Earth and would actually strip off all of the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So without an iron core, we'd all suffocate.
That's a good one to end on. Thank you very much for answering my questions. It's
Thank
been
you.
Fantastic, and I've learned so much.
So have
it's
I.
Been great.